But there was just so much of it. An embarrassing, ridiculous excess. My mind keeps going back over Prince Dane's white ribs, the spray of blood from Elowen's throat, and the High King's denying Baelkin over and over as he died. Over poor Taniot and Kalia and Rhaya, who were forced to discover each in turn how the Crown of Faerie mattered more than their lives. I think of Matic, who had been at Dane's right hand all these years. Faeries might not be able to lie outright, but Matic had lied with every laugh, every clap on the back, every shared cup of wine. Matic, who'd let us all get dressed up and given me a beautiful sword to wear tonight, as though we were really going to some fun party. I knew what he was, I tried to tell myself. I saw the blood crusted on his red cap. If I let myself forget, then more fool me. At least knights had led my family away before the killing started. At least none of the others had to watch. Although, unless they were very far away, they could not have failed to hear the screams. At least Oak would not grow up as I have, with death as my birthright. I sit there until my heart slows again. I need to get out of the hill. This revel is going to turn wilder, and with no new High Monarch on the throne, there is little holding any of the revelers back from any entertainment they can devise. It's probably not the best time to be immortal here. I try to remember looking down on the layout of the throne room from above with the ghost. I try to recall the entrances into the main part of the castle. If I could find one of the guards and make them believe that I was part of Maddox's household, they might take me to the rest of my family. But I don't want to go. I don't want to see Matic, covered in blood, sitting beside Baelkin. I don't want to pretend that what happened is anything other than horrific. I don't want to disguise my disgust. There's another way out. I can crawl under the tables to the steps and go up them to the ledge near Matic's strategy room. I think from there, I can climb directly through and be in the part of the castle most likely to be deserted, and the part with access to secret tunnels. From there, I can get out without worrying about knights or guards or anyone else. Adrenaline makes my whole body sing with the desire to move, but although what I have feels like a plan, it's not one yet. I can get out of the palace, but I have nowhere to go after that. Figure it out later, instinct urges. Okay, half a plan is good enough. On my hands and knees, heedless of my dress, heedless of the way the sheath of my sword drags against the packed earth floor, heedless of the pain in my hand, I crawl. Above me, I hear music. I hear other things, too. The snap of what might be bones, a whimper, a howl. I ignore all of it. Then the tablecloth lifts, and as my eyes adjust to the brightness of the candlelight, a masked figure grabs for my arm. There's no easy way to draw my sword, crouched as I am under a table, so I grab for the knife inside my bodice. I am about to strike when I recognize those ridiculous spike-tipped shoes. Cardin, the only one who can legitimately crown Baelkin, the only other descendant of the Greenbriar line left. Everyone in Faerie must be looking for him. And here he is, wandering around in a flimsy silver fox half-mask, blinking at me with drunken confusion and swaying a bit on his feet. I almost laugh outright. Imagine my luck to be the one to find him.
You're mortal,
he informs me. In his other hand, he's carrying an empty goblet, tipped over absently, as though he's forgotten he still carries it.
It's not safe for you here, especially if you go around stabbing everyone.
Not safe for me? Absurdity of the statement aside, I have no idea why he's acting as though he's ever thought about my safety for a moment, except to endanger it. I try to remind myself he must be in shock and grieving, and that might make him behave strangely. But it's hard to think of him as a person who could care about anyone enough to mourn. Right now, he doesn't even seem to care about himself. Get down here before you're recognized.
Playing hide and seek under the table? Crouching in the dirt? Typical of your kind, but far beneath my dignity.
He laughs unsteadily, like he expects I'm going to laugh too. I don't. I ball up my fist and punch him in the stomach, right where I know it will hurt. He staggers to his knees. The goblet drops to the dirt, making a hollow clanking sound.
Ow!
He shouts, and lets me tug him under the table. We'll get out of here without anyone noticing, I tell him. We stay under the tables and make our way to the steps to the upper levels of the palace. And don't tell me it's beneath your dignity to crawl. You're so drunk, you can barely stand anyway. I hear him snort.
If you insist,
he says. It's too dark to see his expression, and even if it wasn't, he's masked. We make our way through the underside of the tables, with ballads and drinking songs sung above us, screams and whispers in the air, and the soft footfalls of dancers echoing around us like rain. My heart is hammering from the bloodshed, from Cardin being so close, from striking him without consequences. I concentrate on him shuffling behind me. Everything smells of packed earth, spilled wine, and blood. I can feel my thoughts spiraling away, can feel myself start to tremble. I bite the inside of my lip to give myself a fresh pain to focus on. I must keep it together. I can't lose it now, not where Cardin will see. And not when a plan is starting to form in my mind. A plan requiring this last prince. I glance back and see that he has stopped moving. He's sitting on the ground, looking at his hand, looking at his ring.
He despised me.
His voice sounds light, conversational, like he's forgotten where he is. Baelkin? I ask, thinking of what I saw at Hollow Hall.
My father,
Cardin snorts.
I didn't much know the others, my brothers and sisters. Isn't that funny? Prince Dane. He didn't want me in the palace, so he forced me out.
I wait, not sure what to say. It's disturbing to see him like this, behaving as though he might have emotions. After a moment, he seems to come back to himself. His eyes focus on me, glittering in the dark.
And now they're all dead. Thanks to Matic, our honorable general. They never should have trusted him. But your mother discovered that a long time ago, didn't she?
I narrow my eyes. Crawl. The corner of his mouth lifts.
You first.
We go from table to table, until finally we're as close as we're likely to get to the steps. Cardin pushes back the tablecloth and reaches out his hand toward me, in the gallant manner of someone helping up the person they've been trysting with. Maybe Cardin would say he was doing it for the benefit of onlookers. But we both know he's mocking me. I stand without touching him. The only thing that matters is getting out of the hall before the revel gets bloodier. Before the wrong creature decides I am an amusing plaything. Before Cardin is gutted by someone who doesn't want any high monarch in power. I start toward the steps, but he stops me.
Not like that. Your father's knights will recognize you.
I'm not the one they're looking for, I remind him. He frowns, although his mask hides most of it. Still, I can see it in the turn of his mouth.
If they see your face, they may pay too much attention to whom you're with.
Annoyingly, he's right. If they knew me at all, they'd know I'd never be with you. Which is ridiculous, since I am currently standing beside him. Although it makes me feel better to say it. With a sigh, I take down my braids, rubbing my hands through my hair until it hangs wild in my face.
"You look,"
he says, and then trails off, blinking a few times, not seeming able to finish. I am guessing the hair thing worked better than he had expected. "Give me a second," I say, and I plunge into the crowd. I don't like risking this, but covering my face is safer than not. I spot a Nixie in a black velvet mask eating a tiny sparrow's heart off a long pin. Sly footing up behind her, I cut the ribbons and catch the mask before it hits the floor. She turns, searching for where it fell, but I am already away. Soon she will abandon looking and eat another delicacy. Or at least I hope she will. It is just a mask, after all. When I return, Cardin is swilling down more wine, his gaze burning into me. I have no idea what he sees, what he's even looking for. A thin rivulet of green liquid pours over his cheek. He reaches for the heavy silver pitcher, as if to pour himself another cup. "Come on," I say, grabbing for his gloved hand with mine. We're to the steps out of the hall when three knights move to block our way.
"Look elsewhere for your pleasure,"
one informs us.
"This is the way to the palace, and it is barred to common folk."
I feel Cardin stiffen beside me, because he's an idiot and cares more about being called common than anyone's safety, sadly even his own. I tug his arm. "We will do as we are bid," I assure the knight, trying to move Cardin away before he does something we will both regret. Cardin, however, will not be moved.
"You are much mistaken in us."
"Shut up, shut up, shut up!"
"The High King Bilkin is a friend to my lady's court,"
Cardin says, silver-tongued in his silver fox mask. He wears an easy half-smile. He's speaking the language of privilege, speaking it with his drawling tone, with the looseness of his limbs, as though he thinks he owns everything he can see. Even drunk, he's convincing.
"You may have heard of Queen Glitten in the Northwest. Bilkin sent a message about the missing prince. He is waiting for an answer."
"I don't suppose you have any proof of that?"
one of the knights asks.
"Of course."
Cardin holds out a fisted hand and opens it to reveal a royal ring gleaming in the center of his palm. I have no idea when he took it off his finger. A neat bit of sleight of hand that I had no idea he could do, no less while inebriated.
"I was given this token so you would know me."
At the sight of the ring, they step back. With an obnoxious, too charming smile, Cardin grabs my arm and hauls me past them. Although I have to grit my teeth, I let him. We're on the steps, and it's because of him.
"What about the mortal?"
one of the guards calls. Cardin turns.
"Oh, well, you aren't entirely mistaken in me. I intended to keep some of the delights of the revel for myself,"
he says, and they all smirk. It is all I can do not to knock him to the ground, but there's no dispute, he's clever with words. According to the Baroque rules that govern Fey tongues, everything he said was true enough, so long as you concentrate only on the words. Bilkin is Maddox's friend, and I am part of Maddox's court, if you squint a little. So I am the lady, and the knights probably have heard of Queen Glitten. She's famous enough. And sure, Bilkin is waiting for an answer about the missing prince. He's probably desperate for one. And no one can claim that Cardin's ring isn't meant to be a token by which he's known. As for what he wants to keep from the revel, it could be anything. Cardin is clever. But it's not a nice kind of cleverness. And it's a little too close to my own propensity for lying to be comfortable. Still, we're free. Behind us, what should have been a celebration of a new High King continues. The shrieking, The feasting, the whirling around in endless looping dances. I glance back once as we climb, taking in the sea of bodies and wings, ink drop eyes and sharp teeth. I shudder. We climb the steps together. I let him keep his possessive grip on my arm, guiding me. I let him open the doors with his own keys. I let him do whatever he wants. And then, once we're in the empty hall in the upper level of the palace, I turn and press the point of my knife directly underneath his chin. "Jude?" he asks, up against the wall, pronouncing my name carefully, as though to avoid slurring. I'm not sure I have ever heard him use my actual name before. "Surprised?" I ask, a fierce grin starting on my face. The most important boy in Faerie, and my enemy, finally in my power. It feels even better than I thought it would. You shouldn't be. Chapter 22. I press the tip of the knife against his skin so he can feel the bite. His black eyes focus on me with new intensity.
"Why?"
he asks. "Just that." Seldom have I felt such a rush of triumph. I have to concentrate on keeping it from going to my head, stronger than wine. "Because your luck is terrible, and mine is great. Do what I say, and I'll delay the pleasure of hurting you."
"Planning to spill a little more royal blood tonight?"
he sneers, moving as if to shrug off the knife. I move with him, keeping it against his throat. He keeps talking.
"Feeling left out of the slaughter?"
"You're drunk," I say.
"Oh, indeed."
He leans his head back against the stone, closing his eyes. Nearby torchlight turns his black hair to bronze.
"But do you really believe I am going to let you parade me in front of the general, as though I am some lowly..."
I press the knife harder. He sucks in a breath and bites off the end of that sentence.
"Of course,"
he says a moment later, with a laugh full of self-mockery.
"I was passed out cold while my family was murdered. It's hard to fall more lowly than that."
"Stop talking," I tell him, pushing aside any twinge of sympathy. He never had any for me. "Move."
"Or what?"
he asks, still not opening his eyes.
"You're not really going to stab me."
"When was the last time you saw your dear friend, Valerian?" I whisper. "Not today, despite the insult implied by his absence. Did you wonder at that?" His eyes open. He looks as though I slapped him awake.
"I did. Where is he?"
"Rotting near Maddox Stables. I killed him. And then I buried him. So believe me when I threaten you. No matter how unlikely it seems, you are the most important person in all of Faerie. Whosoever has you has power. And I want power."
"I suppose you were right after all."
He studies my face, giving nothing away on his own.
"I suppose I didn't know the least of what you could do."
I try not to let him know how much his calmness rattles me. It makes me feel as though the knife in my hand, which should lend me authority, isn't enough. It makes me want to hurt him just to convince myself he can be frightened. He's just lost his whole family. I shouldn't be thinking like this. But I can't help thinking that he will exploit any pity on my part, any weakness. "Time to move," I say harshly. "Go to the first door and open it. When we're inside, we're going to the closet. There's a passageway through there."
"Yes, fine,"
he says, annoyed, trying to push my blade away. I hold it steady so that the knife cuts into his skin. He swears and puts a bleeding finger in his mouth.
"What was that for?"
"For fun," I say, and then ease the blade from his throat, slowly and deliberately.
My lip curls, but otherwise I keep my expression as mask-like as I know how. As cruel and cold as the face that reoccurs in my nightmares. It is only as I do it that I realize who I am aping. Whose face frightened me into wanting it for my own. His. My heart is hammering so hard, I feel sick.
Will you at least tell me where we're going?
He asks as I shove him ahead of me with my free hand.
No. Now move.
The growl in my voice is all mine. Unbelievably, he does, swaying as he makes his way down the hall and then into the study I indicate. When we get to the hidden passageway, he crawls in with only a single inscrutable glance back at me. Maybe he's even drunker than I thought. It doesn't matter. He'll sober up soon enough. The first thing I do when I get to the nest of the Court of Shadows is tie Prince Cardin to a chair with shredded pieces of my own dirty dress. Then I remove both of our masks. He lets me do it all, an odd look on his face. No one else is there, and I have no idea when anyone might come back, if they will at all. It doesn't matter. I can manage without them. I have made it this far, after all. When Cardin found me, I knew that having control of him was the only path to having some control over the fate of my world. I think of all the vows I made to Dane, including the one I never spoke out loud. Instead of being afraid, I will become something to fear. If Dane isn't going to give me power, then I am going to take it for myself. Not having spent much time in the Court of Shadows, I don't know its secrets. I walk through rooms, opening heavy wooden doors, opening cabinets, taking inventory of my supplies. I discover a pantry that is as full of poisons as it is of cheeses and sausages, a training room with sawdust on the floor, weapons on the wall, and a new wooden dummy in the center, its face crudely painted with a disturbing grin. I go into the back room with four pallets on the ground and a few mugs and discarded clothing spread out near them. I touch none of it, until I come to the map room with a desk. Dane's desk, stuffed with scrolls and pens and sealing wax. For a moment, I am overwhelmed by the enormity of what has happened. Prince Dane is gone. Gone forever. And his father and sisters are gone with him. I go back to the main room and drag Cardin and the chair into Dane's office, propping it against the open door so I can keep an eye on him. I take down a handheld crossbow from the wall in the training room, along with a few bolts. Weapon beside me, cocked and ready. I sit down in Dane's chair and rest my head in my hands.
Will you tell me where exactly we are, now that I'm trussed up to your satisfaction?
I want to strike Cardin over and over until I slap that smugness off his face. But if I did, he'd know just how much he scares me. This is where Prince Dane's spies meet, I inform him, trying to shake off my fear. I need to concentrate. Cardin is nothing. An instrument. A gambling marker. He fixes me with an odd, startled look.
How do you know that? What possessed you to bring me here?
I'm trying to figure out what to do next, I say, with uncomfortable honesty.
And if one of the spies returns?
He asks me, rousing from his stupor enough to actually seem concerned.
They're going to discover you in their lair and...
He trails off at the smirk on my face and subsides into stunned silence. I can see the moment he arrives at the realization that I'm one of them. That I belong here. Cardin lapses back into silence. Finally. Finally, I've made him flinch. I do something I would never dare to do before. I go through Prince Dane's desk. There are mounds of correspondence, lists, notes, neither to Dane nor from him. Probably stolen. More in his hand. Movements, riddles, proposals for laws. Formal invitations. Informal and innocuous letters, including a few from Matic. I am not sure what I am looking for. I am just scanning everything as quickly as I can for something, anything that might give me some idea of why he was betrayed. All my life, I grew up thinking of the High King and Prince Dane as our unquestioned rulers. I believed Matic to be entirely loyal to them. I was loyal, too. I knew Matic was bloodthirsty. I guess I knew he wanted more conquest, more war, more battle. But I thought he considered wanting war to be part of his role as the general, while part of the High King's role was to keep him in check. Matic talked about honor, about obligation, about duty. He'd raised Taryn and me in the name of those things. It seemed logical he was willing to put up with other unpleasantness. I didn't think Matic even liked Baelkin. I recall the dead messenger, shot by me, and the note in the scroll. Kill the bearer of this message. It was a piece of misdirection, all meant to keep Dane's spies busy chasing our tails while Baelkin and Matic planned to strike in the one place no one looked. Right out in the open. Did you know? I asked Carden. Did you know what Baelkin was going to do? Is that why you weren't with the rest of your family? He barks out a laugh.
If you think that, why do you suppose I didn't run straight into Baelkin's loving arms?
Tell me anyway, I say.
I didn't know, he says. Did you? Matic's your father, after all.
I take out a long bar of wax from Dane's desk. One end blackened. What does it matter what I say? I could lie.
Tell me anyway, he says, and yawns. I really want to slap him.
I didn't know either, I admit, not looking at him. Instead, I am staring at the pile of notes, at the soft wax impressions, an intaglio in reverse. And I should have. My gaze cuts toward Carden. I walk over to him, squat down, and begin to prize off his royal ring. He tries to pull his hand out of my grasp, but he's tied in such a way that he can't. I yank it off his finger. I hate how I feel around him, the irrational panic when I touch his skin. I'm just borrowing your stupid ring, I say. The signet fits perfectly into the impression on the letter. All the rings of all the princes and princesses must be identical. That means a seal from one looks much like the seal from another. I pull out a fresh piece of paper and begin to write.
I don't suppose you have anything to drink around here, Carden asks. I don't imagine that whatever happens next is going to be particularly comfortable for me, and I would like to stay drunk in order to face it.
Do you really think I care if you're comfortable? I demand. I hear a footfall and stand up from the desk. From the common room comes the sound of smashing glass. I shove Carden's ring into my bodice, where it rests heavily against my skin, and head into the hall. The roach has knocked a line of jars off the bookshelf and cracked the wood of a cabinet. Jagged glass and spilled infusions carpet the stone floor. Mandrake. Snake root. Larkspur. The ghost is grabbing the roach's arm, hauling him back from smashing more things. Despite the line of blood streaking down his leg. The stiffness of his movements. The ghost has been in a fight. Hey, I say. Both look surprised to see me. They are even more surprised when they notice Prince Carden tied to a chair in the doorway of the map room.
Shouldn't you be with your father, celebrating?
The ghost spits. I take a step back. Before, he's always been a model of perfect, unnatural calm. Neither of them seems calm now.
The bomb is still out there. And both of them nearly gave their lives to free me from Baelkin's dungeon, only to find you here gloating.
No, I say, holding my ground. Think about it. If I knew what was going to happen, if I was on Maddox's side, the only way I would be here is with a retainer of knights. You'd have been shot coming in the door. I would hardly have come alone, dragging along a prisoner that my father would dearly love to have.
Peace, both of you. We're all of us reeling,
the roach says, looking at the damage he has done. He shakes his head. Then his attention goes to Cardan. He walks toward him, studying the prince's face. The roach's black lips pull back from his teeth in a considering grimace. When he turns back to me, he's obviously impressed.
Although it seems that one of us kept her head.
Hello,
Cardan says, raising his brows and regarding the roach as though they were sitting down to tea together. Cardan's clothes are disarranged, from crawling under tables or being captured and tied, and his infamous tail is showing under the white lawn of his shirt. It is slim, nearly hairless, with a tuft of black fur at the tip. As I watch, the tail forms one wavering curve after another, snaking back and forth, betraying his cool face, telling its own story of uncertainty and fear. I can see why he hides that thing away.
We should kill him, says the ghost, slouching in the hallway, light brown hair blown across his forehead.
He's the only member of the royal family who can crown Baelkin. Without Cardan, the throne will be forever lost, and we will have avenged Dane.
Cardan draws a sharp breath and then lets it out slowly.
I'd prefer to live. We don't work for Dane anymore,
the roach reminds the ghost, the nostrils of his long green knife of a nose flaring.
Dane's dead, and beyond caring about thrones or crowns. We sell the prince back to Baelkin for everything we can get and leave. Go among the low courts or the free folk. There's fun to be had, and gold. You could come along, Jude, if you want.
The offer is tempting. Burn it all down. Run. Start over in a place where no one knows me except the ghost and the roach.
I don't want Baelkin's money,
the ghost spits on the ground.
And other than that, the boy prince is useless to us. Too young, too weak. If not for Dane, then let's kill him for all of Faerie.
Too young, too weak, too mean, I put in.
Wait,
Cardan says. I have imagined him afraid many times. But the reality outstrips those imaginings. Seeing the quickening of his breath, the way he pulls against my careful knots, delights me.
Wait. I could tell you what I know. Everything I know. Anything about Baelkin. Anything you'd like. If you want gold and riches, I could get them for you. I know the way to Baelkin's treasury. I have the 10 keys to the 10 locks of the palace. I could be useful.
Only in my dreams has Cardan ever been like this. Begging. Miserable. Powerless.
What did you know about your brother's plan?
The ghost asks him, peeling himself off the wall. He limps over. Cardan shakes his head.
Only that Baelkin despised Dane. I despised him as well. He was despicable. I didn't know he'd manage to convince Maddox of that.
What do you mean, despicable? I ask, indignant, even with the still healing wound on my hand. Dane's death washed away the resentment I had for him. Cardan gives me an indecipherable look.
Dane poisoned his own child. Still in the womb.
He worked on our father until he trusted no one but Dane. Ask them. Surely Dane's spies know how he made Eldred believe that Elowyn was plotting against him, convinced him that Baelkin was a fool. Dane orchestrated my being thrown out of the palace so that I had to be taken in by my elder brother or go without any home at the court. He even persuaded Eldred to step down after poisoning his wine so that he became tired and ill. The curse on the crown doesn't prevent that. That can't be true. I think of Liriope, of the letter, of how Baelkin wanted proof of who got the poison. But Eldred couldn't have been poisoned with blusher mushroom.
Ask your friends,
Cardin says, with a nod to the roach and the ghost.
It was one of them who administered the poison that killed the child and its mother.
I shake my head, but the ghost doesn't meet my gaze. Why would Dane do that?
Because he fathered the child with Eldred's consort and was afraid Eldred would find out and choose another of us for his heir.
Cardin seems pleased with himself at having surprised me. Surprised us, from the looks on the faces of the roach and the ghost. I do not like the way they watch him now, as though he might have value after all.
Even the King of Faerie doesn't like to think of his son taking his place in a lover's bed.
It shouldn't shock me that the Court of Faerie is corrupt and kind of gross. I knew that, just as I knew Madoc could do gruesome things to people he cared about. Just as I knew Dane was never kind. He made me stab my own hand, clean through. He took me on for my usefulness, nothing more. Faerie might be beautiful, but its beauty is like a golden stag's carcass, crawling with maggots beneath her hide, ready to burst. I feel sick from the smell of blood. It's on my dress, under my fingers, in my nose. How am I supposed to be worse than the folk? Sell the prince back to Baelkin. I turn the idea over in my mind. Baelkin would be in my debt. He'd make me a member of the court, just as I once wanted. He'd give me anything I asked for. Any of the things Dane offered, and more. Land, knighthood, a love mark on my brow so all who looked upon me would be sick with desire. A sword that wove charms with every blow. And yet, none of those things seems all that valuable anymore. None of those are true power. True power isn't granted. True power can't be taken away. I think of what it will be like to have Baelkin for a high king. For the circle of Grackles to devour all the other circles of influence. I think of his starveling servants, of his urging Cardin to kill one of them for training, of the way he ordered Cardin beaten while professing his love for their family. No, I cannot see myself serving Baelkin. Prince Cardin is my prisoner, I remind them, pacing back and forth. I'm not good at much. And I've been good at being a spy for only a very short time. I am not ready to give that up. I get to decide what happens to him. The roach and the ghost exchange glances. Unless we're going to fight, I say. Because they're not my friends. And I need to remember that. But I have access to Madoc. I have access to Baelkin. I'm our best shot at brokering a deal.
Jude?
Cardin cautions me from the chair, but I am beyond caution, especially from him. There's a tense moment when the roach cracks a grin.
No, girl, we're not fighting. If you've got a plan, then I'm glad of it. I'm not really much of a planner, unless it's how to prize out a gem from a nice setting. You stole the boy, Prince. This is your play. If you think you can make it.
The ghost frowns, but doesn't contradict him. What I must do is put the puzzle pieces together. Here's what doesn't make sense. Why is Matic backing Baelkin? Baelkin is cruel and volatile, two qualities not preferable in a monarch. Even if Matic believes Baelkin will give him the wars he wants, it seems as though he could have gotten those some other way. I think of the letter I found on Baelkin's desk, the one to Nikasia's mother. I know the provenance of the blusher mushroom that you ask after. Why, after all this time, would Baelkin want proof that Dane orchestrated Liriope's murder? And if he had it, why hadn't he taken it to Eldred? Unless he had, and Eldred hadn't believed him. Or cared. Or, unless the proof was for someone else. When was Liriope poisoned, I ask?
7 years ago. In the month of storms,
the ghost says, with a twist in his mouth.
Dane told me that he'd been given a foresight about the child. Is this important, or are you just curious?
What was the foresight? I ask. He shakes his head, as if he doesn't want the memory, but he answers.
If the boy was born, Prince Dane would never be king.
What a typical fairy prophecy. One that gives you a warning about what you'll lose, but never promises you anything. The boy is dead, but Prince Dane will never be king. Let me not be that kind of fool, to base my strategies on riddles.
So it's true,
the roach says quietly.
You're the one who killed her.
The ghost's frown deepens. It didn't occur to me until then that they might not know one another's assignments. Both of them look uncomfortable. I wonder if the roach would have done it. I wonder what it means that the ghost did. When I look at him now, I don't know what I see. I'm going to go home, I say. I'll pretend I got lost at the coronation revel. I should be able to figure out what Cardin is worth to them. I'll come back tomorrow and run the particulars by you both and the bomb, if she's here. Give me a day to see what I can do, and your oath to make no decisions until then.
If the bomb has better sense than we do, she's already gone to ground.
The roach points to a cabinet. Wordlessly, the ghost goes and gets out a bottle, placing it on the worn wooden table.
How do we know you won't betray us? Even if you think you're on our side now, you might get back to that stronghold of Matic's and reconsider.
I eye the roach and the ghost speculatively. I'll have to leave Cardin in your care, which means trusting you. I promise not to betray you, and you promise that the prince will be here when I get back. Cardin looks relieved at the idea that there will be a delay, whatever happens next. Or perhaps he's just relieved by the presence of the bottle.
You could be a kingmaker, the ghost says. That's seductive. You could make Baelkin even more deeply indebted to your father.
He's not my father, I say sharply. And if I decide that I want to throw in with Matic, well then, so long as you get paid, it won't matter, will it?
I guess not.
The ghost says grudgingly.
But if you come back here, with Matic or anyone else, we'll kill Cardin. And then we'll kill you. Understood?
I nod. If it wasn't for Prince Dane's Gesh, they might have compelled me. Of course, whether Prince Dane's Gesh lasted past his death, I do not know, and I'm afraid to find out.
And if you take more than the day you asked for to get back, we'll kill him and cut our losses.
The ghost continues.
Prisoners are like damson plums. The longer you keep them, the less valuable they become. Eventually, they spoil. One day and one night. Don't be late.
Cardin flinches and tries to catch my eye, but I ignore him. I'll agree to that, I say, because I am no fool. None of us is feeling all that trusting at the moment. So long as you swear Cardin will be here and hale when I return tomorrow, alone. And because they're not fools either, they swear it. Chapter 23. I don't know what I expect to find when I get home. It's a long walk through the woods, longer because I give the encampments of the folk here for the coronation a wide berth. My dress is dirty and tattered at the hem. My feet are sore and cold. When I arrive, Maddox Estate looks the way it always does, familiar as my own step. I think of all the other dresses hanging in my closet, waiting to be worn, the slippers waiting to be danced in. I think of the future I thought I was going to have, and the one yawning in front of me like a chasm. In the hall, I see that there are more knights here than I am used to, coming in and out of Maddox's parlor. Servants rush back and forth, bringing tankards and inkpots and maps. Few spare me a look. There's a cry from across the hall. Vivienne. She and Oriana are in the parlor. Vivi runs toward me, throws her arms around me. I was going to kill him, she says. I was going to kill him if his stupid plan got you hurt. I realize I have not moved. I bring one hand up to touch her hair, let my finger slip to her shoulder. I'm fine, I say. I just got swept up in the crowd. I'm fine. Everything's fine. Everything is, of course, not at all fine. But no one tries to contradict me. Where are the others? Oak is in bed, Oriana says. And Taryn is outside Maddox's study. She'll be along in a moment. Vivi's expression shifts at that, although I am not sure how to read it. I go up the stairs to my room, where I wash the paint off my face and the mud off my feet. Vivi follows me, perches on a stool. Her cat eyes are bright gold in the sunlight, streaming in from my balcony. She doesn't speak as I take a comb to my hair, raking through the tangles. I dress myself in dark colors, in a deep blue tunic with a high collar and tight sleeves, in shiny black boots, with new gloves to cover my hands. I strap Nightfell onto a heavier belt and surreptitiously put the ring with the royal seal into my pocket. It feels so surreal to be in my room, with my stuffed animals and my books and my collection of poisons, with Cardin's copy of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass sitting on my bedside table. A new wave of panic passes over me. I'm supposed to figure out how to turn the capture of the missing Prince of Faerie to my advantage. Here, in my childhood home. I want to laugh at my daring. Just who do I think I am? What happened to your throat? Vivi asks, frowning at me. And what's wrong with your left hand? I forgot how carefully I had concealed those injuries. They're not important. Not with everything that happened. Why did he do it?
You mean, why did Maddox help Bilkin?
She says, lowering her voice.
I don't know. Politics? He doesn't care about murder. He doesn't care that it's his fault Princess Rhea is dead. He doesn't care, Jude. He never cared. That's what makes him a monster.
Maddox can't really want Bilkin to rule Elfheim, I say. Bilkin would influence how Faerie interacts with the mortal world for centuries. How much blood is shed, and whose. All of Faerie will be like Hollow Hall. That's when I hear Taryn's voice float up the stairwell. Locke has been in with Maddox for ages. He doesn't know anything about where Cardin is hiding. Vivi goes still, watching my face. Jude, she says. Her voice is mostly breath. Maddox probably just trying to frighten him, Oriana says. You know he's not keen on arranging a marriage in the middle of all this turmoil. Before Vivi can say anything else, before she can stop me, I've gone to the top of the stairs. I recall the words Locke said to me after I'd fought in the tournament and pissed off Cardin. You're like a story that hasn't happened yet. I want to see what you will do. I want to be part of the unfolding of the tale. When he said that he wanted to see what I would do, did he mean to find out what would happen if he broke my heart? If I can't find a good enough story, I make one. Cardin's words, when I asked if he thought I didn't deserve Locke, echo in my head. Oh no, he'd said with a smirk. You're perfect for each other. And at the coronation, time to change partners. Oh, did I steal your line? He knew. How he must have laughed. How they all must have laughed. So I suppose I know who your lover is now, I call to my twin sister. Taryn looks up and blanches. I descend the stairs slowly, carefully. I wonder if, when Locke and his friends laughed, she laughed with them. All the odd looks, the tension in her voice when I talked about Locke, her concern about what he and I were doing in the stables, what we'd done at his house. All of it makes sudden, awful sense. I feel the sharp stab of betrayal. I draw Nightfell. I challenge you, I tell Taryn, to a duel. For my honor, which was grievously betrayed. Taryn's eyes widen. I wanted to tell you, she says. There were so many times I started to say something, but I just couldn't. Locke said if I could endure, it would be a test of love. I remember his words from the revel. Do you love me enough to give me up? Isn't that a test of love? I guess she passed the test, and I failed. So he proposed to you, I say, while the royal family got butchered. That's so romantic. Orianna gives a little gasp, probably afraid that Matic would hear me, that he'd object to my characterization. Taryn looks a little pale too. I suppose since none of them actually saw it, they could have been told nearly anything. One doesn't have to lie to deceive. My hand tightens on the hilt of Nightfell. What did Cardin say that made you cry the day after we came back from the mortal world? I remember my hands buried in his velvet doublet, his back hitting the tree when I shoved him. And then later, how she denied it had anything to do with me. How she wouldn't tell me what it did have to do with. For a long moment, she doesn't answer. By her expression, I know she doesn't want to tell me the truth. It was about this, wasn't it? He knew. They all knew. I think of Nikasia sitting at Locke's dining table, seeming for a moment to take me into her confidence. He ruins things. That's what he likes. To ruin things. I thought she'd been talking about Cardin. He said it was because of me that he kicked dirt onto your food, Taryn says, voice soft. Locke tricked them into thinking it was you who stole him away from Nikasia. So it was you who they were punishing. Cardin said you were suffering in my place, and that if you knew why, you'd back down. But I couldn't tell you. For a long moment, I do nothing but take in her words. Then I throw my sword down between us. It clangs on the floor. Pick it up, I tell her. Taryn shakes her head. I don't want to fight you. You sure about that? I stand in front of her, in her face, annoyingly close. I can feel how much she itches to take my shoulders and shove. It must have galled her that I kissed Locke. That I slept in his bed. I think maybe you do. I think you'd love to hit me. And I know I want to hit you. There's a sword hung high on the wall over the hearth, beneath a silken banner with Maddox's turned moon crest. I climb onto a nearby chair, step up onto the mantle, and lift it from its hook. It will do. I hop down and walk toward her, pointing steel at her heart. I'm out of practice, she says. I'm not. I close the distance between us. But you'll have the better sword, and you can strike the first blow. That's fair, and more than fair. Taryn looks at me for a long moment, then picks up Nightfell. She steps back several paces and draws. Across the room, Orianna springs to her feet with a gasp. She doesn't come toward us, though. She doesn't stop us. There are so many broken things that I don't know how to fix, but I know how to fight. Don't be idiots, Vivi shouts from the balcony. I cannot give her much of my attention. I am too focused on Taryn as she moves across the floor. Maddox taught us both, and he taught us well. She swings. I block her blow, our swords slamming together. The metal rings out, echoing through the room like a bell. Was it fun to deceive me? Did you like the feeling of having something over me? Did you like that he was flirting and kissing me, and all the while promising you would be his wife? No! She parries my first series of blows with some effort, but her muscles remember technique. She bares her teeth. I hated it. But I'm not like you. I want to belong here. Defying them makes everything worse. You never asked me before you went against Prince Cardin. Maybe he started it because of me, but you kept it going. You didn't care what it brought down on either of our heads. I had to show Locke I was different. A few of the servants have gathered to watch. I ignore them. Ignore the soreness in my arms from digging a grave only a night before. Ignore the sting of the wound through my palm. My blade slices Taryn's skirt, cutting nearly to her skin. Her eyes go wide, and she stumbles back. We trade a series of fast blows. She's breathing harder, not used to being pushed like this, but not backing down either. I beat my blade against hers, not giving her time to do more than defend herself. So this was revenge? We used to spar when we were younger, with practice sticks. And since then we've engaged in hair pulling, shouting matches, and ignoring each other. But we've never fought like this. Never with live steel. Taryn! Jude! Vivi yells, starting toward the spiral stair. Stop or I will stop you. You hate the folk. Taryn's eyes flash as she spins her sword in an elegant strike. You never cared about Locke. He was just another thing to take from Cardin. That staggers me enough that she's able to get under my guard. Her blade just kisses my side before I whirl away, out of her reach. She goes on. You think I'm weak? You are weak, I tell her. You're weak and pathetic, and I'm a mirror, she shouts. I'm the mirror you don't want to look at. I swing toward Taryn again, putting my whole weight into the strike. I am so angry. Angry at so many things. I hate that I was stupid. I hate that I was tricked. Fury roars in my head, loud enough to drown out my every other thought.
I swing my sword toward her side in a shining arc.
I said, stop!
Vivi shouts, glamour shimmering in her voice like a net.
Now, stop!
Taryn seems to deflate, relaxing her arms, letting Nightfell hang limply from suddenly loose fingers. She has a vague smile on her face, as though she's listening to distant music. I try to check my swing, but it's too late. Instead, I let the sword go. Momentum sends it sailing across the room to slam into a bookshelf and knock a ram skull to the ground. Momentum sends me sprawling on the floor. I turn to Vivi, aghast. You had no right. The words tumble out of my mouth, ahead of the more important ones. I could have sliced Taryn in half. She looks as astonished as I am.
Are you wearing a charm? I saw you change your clothes, and you didn't have one.
Dane's gash. It outlasted his death. My knees feel raw. My hand is throbbing. My side stings where Nightfell grazed my skin. I am furious she stopped the fight. I am furious she tried to use magic on us. I push myself to my feet. My breath comes hard. There's sweat on my brow, and my limbs are shaking. Hands grab me from behind. Three more servants pitch in, getting between us and grabbing my arms. Two have Taryn dragging her away from me. Vivi blows in Taryn's face, and she comes to sputtering awareness. That's when I see Matic outside his parlor. Lieutenants and knights crowded around him. And Locke. My stomach drops.
What is wrong with you two?
Matic shouts, as angry as I have ever seen him.
Have we not already had a surfeit of death today?
Which seems like a paradoxical thing to say, since he was the cause of so much of it.
Both of you will wait for me in the game room.
All I can think of is him up on the dais, his blade cracking through Prince Dane's chest. I cannot meet his gaze. I am shaking all over. I want to scream. I want to run at him. I feel like a child again, a helpless child in a house of death. I want to do something, but I do nothing. He turns to Gnarbone.
Go with them. Make sure they stay away from each other.
I am led into the game room and sit on the floor with my head in my hands. When I bring them away, they are wet with tears. I wipe my fingers quickly against my pants before Taryn can see. We wait at least an hour. I don't say a single thing to Taryn, and she doesn't say anything to me either. She sniffles a little, then wipes her nose and doesn't weep. I think of Cardin tied to a chair to cheer myself. Then I think of the way he looked up at me through the curtain of his crow-black hair, of the curling edges of his drunken smile, and I don't feel in the least bit comforted. I feel exhausted and utterly, completely defeated. I hate Taryn. I hate Matic. I hate Locke. I hate Cardin. I hate everyone. I just don't hate them enough.
What did he give you?
I ask Taryn, finally tiring of the silence.
Matic gave me the sword Dad made. That's the one we were fighting with. He said he had something for you, too.
She's quiet long enough that I don't think she's going to answer.
A set of knives for a table. Supposedly, they cut right through bone. The sword is better. It has a name.
I guess you could name your steak knives.
Meaty the Elder? Gristlebane? I say. And she makes a little snorting noise that sounds like the smothering of a laugh. But after that, we lapse back into silence. Finally, Matic enters the room, his shadow preceding him, spreading across the floor like a carpet. He tosses a scabbarded nightfell onto the ground in front of me, and then settles himself on a couch with legs in the shape of bird feet. The couch groans, unused to taking so much weight. Narbonne nods at Matic and sees himself out.
Taryn, I would talk with you of Locke,
Matic says. Did you hurt him? There is a barely contained sob in her voice. Unkindly, I wonder if she's putting it on for Maddox's benefit. He snorts, as though maybe he's wondering the same thing.
When he asked for your hand, he told me that although, as I knew, the folk are changeable people, he'd still like to take you to wife. Which is to mean, I suppose, that you will not find him particularly constant. He said nothing about a dalliance with Jude then. But when I asked a moment ago, he told me, mortal feelings are so volatile that it's impossible to help toying with them a little. He told me that you, Taryn, had shown him that you could be like us. No doubt whatever you did to show him, that was the source of conflict between you and your sister.
Taryn's dress is pillowed around her. She looks composed, although she has a shallow slash on her side and a cut skirt. She looks like a lady of the gentry, if one does not stare over much at the rounded curves of her ears. When I allow myself to truly think on it, I cannot fault Locke for choosing her. I am violent. I've been poisoning myself for weeks. I am a killer and a liar. And a spy. I get why he chose her. I just wish she had chosen me. What did you say to him? Taryn asks.
That I have never found myself particularly changeable,
Matic says.
And that I found him to be unworthy of both of you.
Taryn's hands curl into fists at her side. But there is no other sign that she is angry. She has mastered a kind of courtly composure that I have not. While I have studied under Matic, her tutor has been Oriana. Do you forbid me from accepting him?
It will not end well,
Matic says.
But I will not stand in front of your happiness. I will not even stand in front of misery that you choose for yourself.
Taryn says nothing, but the way she lets out her breath shows her relief.
Go,
he tells her,
and no more fighting with your kin. Whatever pleasure you find with Locke, your loyalty is to your family.
I wonder what he means by that, by loyalty. I thought he was loyal to Dane. I thought he was sworn to him. But she, Taryn begins. And Matic holds up a hand, with the menace of his curved black fingernails.
Was the challenger? Did she thrust a sword into your hand and make you swing it? Do you really think that your sister has no honor? That she would chop you into pieces while you stood by unarmed?
Taryn glowers, putting her chin up.
I didn't want to fight.
Then you ought not to do so in the future,
Matic says.
There's no point in fighting if you're not intending to win. You may go. Leave me to talk with your sister.
Taryn stands and walks to the door. With her hand on the heavy brass latch, she turns back, as though to say something else. Whatever camaraderie we found when he wasn't there is gone. I can see in her face that she wants him to punish me, and is half sure that he won't.
You should ask Jude where Prince Cardin is, she says,
narrow-eyed. The last time I saw him, he was dancing with her. With that, she sweeps out the door, leaving me with a thundering heart and the royal seal burning in my pocket. She doesn't know. She's just being awful. Just trying to get me in trouble with a parting shot. I cannot believe she would say that if she knew.
Let's talk about your behavior tonight,
says Matic, leaning forward. Let's talk about your behavior tonight, I return. He sighs and rubs one large hand over his face.
You were there, weren't you? I tried to get you all out, so you wouldn't have to see it.
I thought you loved Prince Dane, I say. I thought you were his friend.
I loved him well enough,
Matic says.
Better than I will ever love Belkin. But there are others who have a claim on my loyalty.
I think again of my puzzle pieces, of the answers I came back home to get. What could Belkin have given or promised Matic that would have persuaded him to move against Dane? Who, I demand. What could be worth this much death?
Enough,
he growls.
You are not yet on my war council. You will know what there is to know in the fullness of time. Until then, let me assure you that although things are in disarray, my plans are not overturned. What I need now is the youngest prince. If you know where Cardin is, I could get Belkin to offer you a handsome reward, a position in his court, and the hand of anyone you wanted, or the still-beating heart of anyone you despised.
I look at him in surprise. You think I'd take Locke from Terran? He shrugs.
You seemed like you wanted to take Terran's head from her shoulders. She played you false. I don't know what you might consider a fitting punishment.
For a moment, we just look at each other. He's a monster. So if I want to do a very bad thing, he's not going to judge me for it. Much.
If you want my advice,
he says slowly,
love doesn't grow well, fed on pain. Grant me that I know that, at least. I love you. And I love Terran. But I don't think she's suited for Locke.
And I am? I cannot help thinking that Maddox's idea of love doesn't seem like a very safe thing. He loved my mother. He loved Prince Dane. His love for us is likely to afford us no more protection than it afforded either of them.
I don't think Locke is suited for you.
He smiles his toothy smile.
And if your sister is right, and you do know where Prince Cardin is, give him to me. He's a foppish sort of boy, no good with a sword. He's charming in a way, and clever. But nothing worth protecting.
Too young, too weak, too mean. I think again of the coup that Matic had planned with Belkin, wondering how it was supposed to go. Kill the two elder siblings, the ones with influence? Then surely the High King would relent and put the crown on the head of the prince with the most power. The one with the military on his side. Perhaps grudgingly, but once threatened, Eldred would crown Belkin. Except he didn't. Belkin tried to force his hand, and then everyone died. Everyone but Cardin. The board swept nearly clear of players. That can't be how Matic thought things would play out. But still, I remember his lessons on strategy. Every outcome of a plan should lead to victory. No one can really plan for every variable, though. That's ridiculous. I thought you were supposed to lecture me about not sword fighting in the house, I say, trying to steer the conversation away from the whereabouts of Cardin. I've gotten what I promised the Court of Shadows. An offer. Now I just have to decide what to do with it.
Must I tell you that if your blade had struck true and you'd hurt Taryn, you would have regretted it all your days? Of all the lessons I imparted on you, I would have thought that was the one I taught you best.
His gaze is steady on mine. He's talking about my mother. He's talking about murdering my mother. I can say nothing to that.
It is a shame you didn't take out that anger on someone more deserving. In times like these, the folk go missing.
He gives me a significant look. Is he telling me it's okay to kill Locke? I wonder what he'd say if he knew I'd already killed one of the gentry. If I showed him the body. Apparently, maybe. Congratulations. How do you sleep at night? I ask him. It's a crappy thing to say, and I am only saying it, I know, because he has shown me just how close I am to being everything I have despised in him. His eyebrows furrow, and he looks at me as though he's evaluating what sort of answer to give. I imagine myself as he must see me, a sullen girl sitting in judgment of him.
Some are good with pipes or paint. Some have skill in love,
he says finally.
My talent is in making war. The only thing that has ever kept me awake was denying it.
I nod slowly. He gets up.
Think about what I said, and then think about where your own talents lie.
We both know what that means. We both know what I am good at. What I am. I just chased my sister around the downstairs with a sword. But what to do with that talent is the question. As I exit the game room, I realize that Baelkin must have arrived with his retainers. Knights with his livery. Three laughing birds emblazoned on their tabards. Stand at attention in the hall. I slink past them and up the stairs, dragging my sword behind me, too exhausted to do anything else. I am hungry, I realize, but I feel too sick to eat. Is this what it is to be brokenhearted? I am not sure it is Locke I am sick over, so much as the world the way it was before the coronation began. But if I could undo the passing of the days, why not unwind them to before I killed Valyrian? Why not unwind them until my parents are alive? Why not unwind them all the way to the beginning? There's a knock on my door, and then it opens without my signaling anything. Vivi comes in, carrying a wooden plate with a sandwich on it, along with a stoppered bottle of amber glass. I'm a jerk. I'm an idiot, I say. I admit it. You don't have to lecture me.
I thought you were going to give me a hard time about the glamour, she says. You know, the one you resisted.
You shouldn't magic your sisters. I draw the cork on the bottle and take a long swig of water. I didn't realize how thirsty I was. I guzzle more, nearly draining the whole container in one continuous gulping swallow.
And you shouldn't try to chop yours in half.
She settles back against my pillows, against my worn stuffed animals. Idly, she picks up the snake and flicks the fork of its felt tongue.
I thought all of it. Swordplay, knighthood. I thought it was a game.
I remember how angry she was when Taryn and I gave in to Fairy and started having fun. Crowns of flowers on our heads. Shooting bows and arrows at the sky, eating candied violets, and falling asleep with our heads pillowed on logs. We were children. Children can laugh all day and still cry themselves to sleep at night. But to hold a blade in my hand, a blade like the one that killed our parents, and think it was a toy, she'd have to believe I was heartless. It's not, I say finally.
No,
Vivi says, wrapping the stuffed snake around the stuffed cat. Did she tell you about him? I ask, climbing onto my bed next to her. It feels good to lie down. Maybe a little too good. I am instantly drowsy. I didn't know Taryn was with Locke, Vivi says, deliberately giving me the whole sentence so I won't have to wonder if she's trying to trick me.
But I don't want to talk about Locke. Forget him. I want us to leave Faerie. Tonight.
That makes me sit upright. What? She laughs at my reaction. It's such a normal sound, so completely out of step with the high drama of the last 2 days.
I thought that would surprise you.
Look, whatever happens next here, it's not going to be good. Bailkin's an asshole, and he's dumb on top of it. You should have heard Dad swearing on our way home. Let's just go. What about Taryn, I ask. I've already asked her, and I'm not going to tell you if she agreed to come or not. I want you to answer for you. Jude, listen. I know you're keeping secrets. Something is making you sick. You're paler and thinner, and your eyes have a weird shine. I'm fine, I say.
Liar, she says.
But the accusation has no heat.
I know that you're stuck here in Faerie because of me. I know that the shittiest things that have happened in your whole life are because of me. You've never said it, which is kind of you. But I know. You've had to turn yourself into something else. And you've done it. Sometimes when I look at you, I'm not sure if you'd even know how to be human anymore.
I don't know what to do with that. Compliment and insult, all at once. But behind it is a feeling of prophecy.
You fit in better here than I do, Vivi says. But I bet it cost you something.
I mostly don't like to imagine the life I could have had. The one without magic in it. The one where I went to a regular school and learned regular things. The one where I had a living father and mother. The one where my older sister was the weirdo. Where I wasn't so angry. Where my hands weren't stained with blood. I picture it now. And I feel strange. Tense all over. My stomach churning.
What I feel is panic.
When the wolves come for that, Jude, she'll be eaten up in an instant. And wolves always come. It frightens me to think of myself so vulnerable. But as I am now, I am well on my way to becoming one of the wolves. Whatever essential thing the other Jude has, whatever part that's unbroken in her and broken in me, that thing might be unrecoverable. Vivia's right. It cost me something to be the way I am. But I do not know what. And I don't know if I can get it back. I don't even know if I want it. But maybe I could try. What would we do in the mortal world? I ask her. Vivi smiles and pushes the plate with the sandwich toward me.
Go to movies, visit cities, learn to drive a car. There are lots of the folk who don't live in the courts, don't play at politics. We could live any way we like. In a loft, in a tree, whatever we want.
With Heather? I pick up the food and take a huge bite. Sliced mutton and pickled dandelion greens. My stomach growls.
Hopefully, she says. You can help me explain things to her.
It occurs to me for the first time that, whether she knows it or not, she isn't suggesting running away to be human. She was suggesting we live like the wild fae, among mortals, but not of them. We'd steal the cream from their cups and the coins from their pockets. But we wouldn't settle down and get boring jobs. Or at least she wouldn't. I wonder what Heather is going to think of that. Once Prince Cardin is dealt with in some way, then what? Even if I figure out the mystery of Baelkin's letters, there's still no good place for me. The Court of Shadows will be disbanded. Taryn will be wed. Vivi will be gone. I could go with her. I could try to figure out what's broken in me. Try to start over. I think of the Roach's offer. To go with them to another court. To start over in Faerie. Both feel like giving up. But what else is there to do? I thought that once I was home, I'd come up with a plan. But so far I haven't. I couldn't leave tonight, I say hesitatingly. She gasps, hand to her heart.
You're seriously thinking about it?
There are some things I need to finish. Give me a day. I keep bargaining for the same thing over and over. Time. But in a day, I will have squared things with the Court of Shadows. Arrangements will be made for Cardin. One way or another, everything will be settled. I will wring whatever payment I can from Faerie. And if I still don't have a plan, it will be too late to make one. What's a single day in your eternal, everlasting, interminable life?
One day to decide, or one day to pack your bags?
I take another bite of sandwich. Both. Vivi rolls her eyes.
Just remember, in the mortal world, it won't be the way it is here.
She goes to the door.
You wouldn't have to be the way you are here.
I hear Vivi's steps in the hall. I take another bite of my sandwich. I chew and swallow it. But I don't taste anything. What if the way I am is the way I am? What if, when everything else is different, I'm not? I take Cardin's royal ring out of my pocket and hold it in the center of my palm. I shouldn't have this. Mortal hands shouldn't hold it. Even looking closely seems wrong. Yet I do anyway. The gold is full of a deep, rich redness, and the edges are smoothed by constant wear. There's a little bit of wax stuck in the impression, and I try to root it out with the edge of my nail. I wonder how much the ring would be worth out in the world. Before I can persuade myself not to, I slip it onto my unworthy finger.
Chapter 24. I wake up the next afternoon with a taste of poison in my mouth. I had gone to sleep in my clothes, curled around Nightfell's scabbard. Although I don't really want to, I pad down to Taryn's door and knock on it. I have to say something to her before the world turns upside down again. I have to make things right between us. But no one answers. And when I turn the knob and enter, I find her chamber is empty. I head down to Oriana's rooms, hoping she might know where I can find Taryn. I peek in through the open door and find her out on her balcony, looking at the trees and the lake beyond. The wind whips her hair behind her like a pale banner. It balloons her filmy dress. "What are you doing?" I ask, coming in. She turns, surprised. And well, she might be. I am not sure that I have ever sought her out before. "My people had wings once," she says, the longing clear in her voice. "And though I've never had a pair of my own, sometimes I feel the lack of them." I wonder if, when she imagines having wings, she pictures herself flying up into the sky and away from all this. "Have you seen Taryn?" Vines curl around the posts of Oriana's bed, their stems a vivid green. Blue flowers hang down in clumps over where she sleeps, making for a richly perfumed bower. There is nowhere to sit that doesn't seem crawling with plants. It's hard for me to picture Matic comfortable here. "She's gone to the house of her betrothed, but they'll be at the High King Baelkin's manor tomorrow. You will be there too. He's throwing a feast for your father and some of the Seelie and Unseelie rulers. You'll be expected to be less hostile to each other. I cannot even imagine the horror, the awkwardness, of being dressed in gossamer, the smell of fairy fruit heavy in the air, while I am supposed to pretend that Baelkin is anything but a murdering monster. Will Oak go? I ask her, and feel the first real pang of regret. If I leave, I won't get to see Oak grow up. Oriana clasps her hands together and walks over to her dressing table. Her jewelry hangs there, slices of agate on long chains of raw crystal beads, collars set with moonstones, deep green bloodstones strung together, and an opal pendant, bright as fire in the sunlight. And on a silver tray, beside a pair of ruby earrings in the shape of stars, is a golden acorn. A golden acorn, twin to the one I found in the pocket of the gown that Locke gave me, the dress that had belonged to his mother, Liriope, Locke's mother. I think of her madcap, joyful dresses, of her dust-covered bedroom, of how the acorn in her pocket opened to show a bird inside. I try to convince Maddock that Oak was too young and that this dinner will be too dull, but Maddock insisted that he come. Perhaps you can sit beside him and keep him amused. I think about the story of Liriope, of how Oriana told it to me when she believed I was getting too close to Prince Dane, of how Oriana had been a consort to the High King Eldred before she was Maddock's wife. I think about why she might have needed to make a swift marriage, what she might have had to hide. I think about the note I found on Baelkin's desk, the one in Dane's hand, a sonnet to a lady with sunrise hair and starlit eyes. I think about what the bird said. My dearest friend, these are the last words of Liriope. I have 3 golden birds to scatter, 3 attempts to get one into your hand. I am too far gone for any antidote. And so if you hear this, I leave you with the burden of my secrets and the last act of my heart. Protect him. Take him far from the dangers of this court. Keep him safe and never, ever tell him the truth of what happened to me. I think again about strategy, about Dane and Oriana and Maddock. I recall when Oriana first came to us, how quickly Oak was born and how we weren't allowed to see him for months because he was so sickly, about how she has always been protective of him around us. But maybe that was for one reason, when I had assumed another. Just as I'd assumed the child Liriope wanted her friend to take was Locke. But what if the baby she had been carrying didn't die with her? I feel as though I've been robbed of breath, as if getting out words is a struggle against the very air in my lungs. I cannot quite believe what I am about to say, even as I know it's the conclusion that makes sense. Oak isn't Maddox's child, is he? Or, at least, no more Maddox than I am. If the boy is born, Prince Dane will never be king. Oriana claps a hand over my mouth. Her skin smells like the air after a snowfall. Don't say that. She speaks close to my face, voice trembling. Do not ever say that again. If you ever loved Oak, do not say those words. I push her hand away. Prince Dane was his father, and Liriope his mother. Oak is the reason Maddock backed Baelkin, the reason he wanted Dane dead. And now he's the key to the crown. Her eyes widen, and she takes my chilly hand in hers. She has never not seemed strange to me. Like a creature from a fairy tale, pale as a ghost. How could you know that? How could you know any of this, human child? I had thought Prince Cardan was the most valuable individual in all of Faerie. I had no idea. Swiftly, I shut the door and close up her balcony. She watches me and doesn't protest. Where is he now? I ask her. Oak? With his nurse. She whispers. drawing me toward the little divan in one corner, patterned with a snake brocade and covered in a fur. Talk quickly. First, tell me what happened 7 years ago. Oriana takes a deep breath. You might think that I would have been jealous of Liriope for being another of Eldred's consorts. But I wasn't. I loved her. She was always laughing, impossible not to love. Even though her son has come between you and Taryn, I cannot help loving him a little. For her sake. I wonder what it was like for Locke to have his mother be the lover of the High King. I am torn between sympathy and a desire for his life to have been as miserable as possible. We were confidants, Oriana says. She told me when she began her affair with Prince Dane. She didn't seem to take any of it seriously. She had loved Locke's father very much, I think. Dane and Eldred were dalliances, distractions. Our kind do not worry over much about children, as you know. Fairy blood is thin. I don't think it occurred to her that she might have a second son. A mere decade after she bore Locke. Some of us have centuries between children. Some of us never carry any at all. I nod. That's why human men and women are the unacknowledged necessity they are. Without their strengthening the bloodline, fairy would die out, despite the endless span of their lives. Blusher mushroom is a terrible way to die, Oriana says, hand to her throat. You begin to slow, your limbs tremble until you can move no more. But you are still conscious until everything inside you stops. Like frozen clockwork. Imagine the horror of that. Imagine hoping that you might yet move. Imagine straining to move. By the time she got me the message, she was dead. I cut. Her voice falters. I know what the rest of the sentence must be. She must have cut the child out of Liriope's belly. I cannot picture prim Oriana doing such a brutal, brave thing. Pressing the point of her knife into flesh. Finding the right spot and slicing. Prizing a child from a womb. Holding its wet body against her. And yet, who else could have done it? You saved him, I say. Because if she doesn't want to talk about that part, she doesn't have to. I named him for Liriope's acorn, she tells me, her voice barely more than a whisper. My little golden oak. I wanted so badly to believe that being in Dane's service was an honor, that he was someone worth following. That's what comes of hungering for something. You forget to check if it's rotten before you gobble it down. Did you know it was Dane who poisoned Liriope? Oriana shakes her head. Not for a long time. It could have been another of Eldred's lovers. Or Baelkin. There were rumors he was the one responsible. I even wondered if it could have been Eldred. If he had poisoned her for dallying with his son. But then Madoc discovered Dane had obtained the blusher mushroom. He insisted I never let Oak be anywhere near the prince. He was furious. Angry, in a frightening way I had never seen before. It's not hard to see why Madoc would be furious with Dane. Madoc, who once thought his own wife and child were dead. Madoc, who loved Oak. Madoc, who reminded us over and over that family came before all else. And so you married Madoc. Because he could protect you? I have only blurry memories of his courting Oriana. And then they were sworn, with a child on the way. Maybe I thought it was unusual. But anyone can have good fortune. And it had seemed like bad fortune to me at the time, since Taryn and I worried what the new baby would mean for us. We thought Madoc might tire of us, and drop us somewhere with a pocket full of gold and riddles pinned to our shirts. No one finds bad fortune suspicious. Oriana looks out the glass doors at the wind blowing the trees. Maddock and I have an understanding. We do not pretend with each other. I have no idea what that means, but it sounds like it makes for a cold and careful marriage. So what's his play? I ask her. I don't imagine he intends for Baelkin to keep the throne long. I think he would consider it some kind of crime against strategy to leave such an obvious move unexploited. What do you mean? She looks honestly baffled. They don't pretend with each other, my ass. He's going to put Oak on the throne, I tell her, as though it's obvious. Because it is obvious. I don't know how he intends to do it, or when, but I am sure he does. Of course he does. Oak, she says. No, Jude, no. He's just a child. Take him far from the dangers of this court. That's what Lariope's note had said. Maybe Oriana should have listened. I remember what Maddock told us at the dinner table ages ago, about how the throne was vulnerable during a change in power. Whatever he intended to happen with Baelkin. And now I'm wondering if what he imagined was for Dane to die, and Baelkin to die too. For the High King to suspend the coronation. For Maddock to make a different play. He had to see the opportunity in front of him, with only 3 royals left. If Oak was the High King, then Maddock could be the regent. He would rule over Faerie until Oak came of age. And then, who knew what might happen? If he could keep Oak in check, he might rule over Faerie forever. I was just a child once too, I tell her. I don't think Maddock was enormously concerned about what I could handle then. And I don't think he will be too worried about Oak now. It's not like I don't think he loves Oak. Of course he loves him. He loves me too. He loved my mother. But he is what he is. He cannot be other than his nature. Oriana grabs my hand, squeezing it tightly enough that her nails sink into my skin. You don't understand. Child kings do not survive long, and Oak is a frail boy. He was too little when he was brought into this world. No king or queen from any court will bow their heads to him. He wasn't raised for this burden. You must stop it. What might Maddock do with so much power unchecked? What might I do with a brother on the throne? And I could put him there. I have the winning card to play, because while Baelkin would resist crowning Oak, I bet Cardin wouldn't. I could make my brother the High King and myself a princess. All that power is right there for the taking. All I have to do is reach out my hand. The odd thing about ambition is this. You can acquire it like a fever, but it is not so easy to shed. Once, I was content to hope for knighthood and the power to force Cardin and his friends to leave me alone. All I wanted was to find some place to fit in here in Faerie. Now, I wonder what it would be like to choose the next king. I think of the tide of blood running over the stone dais to drip down onto the packed earthen floor of the hill, running over the bottom edge of the crown so that when Baelkin had lifted it, his hands had been smeared red. I imagine that crown on Oak's brow and flinch from the image. I remember, too, what it had felt like to be glamored by Oak. Over and over. I slapped myself until my cheek was red and hot and sore. A bruise bloomed the next morning. A bruise that didn't fade for a week. That's what children do with power. What makes you think I can stop it? I demand. Oriana doesn't release my hand. You once said that I was wrong about you. That you would never hurt Oak. Tell me. Can you do anything? Is there a chance? I'm not a monster, I told her. Back when I said I would never hurt Oak. but maybe being a monster was my calling. Maybe, I tell her, which is no answer at all. On my way out, I spot my little brother. He is out in the garden, picking a bouquet of foxgloves. He's laughing, sunlight turning his brown hair gold. When his nurse comes toward him, he darts away from her. I bet he doesn't even know that those flowers are poison. Chapter 25. Laughter greets me when I return to the Court of Shadows. I'm expecting to find Cardin as I left him, cowed and quiet, perhaps even more miserable than before. Instead, his hands have been untied, and he is at the table, playing cards with the roach, the ghost, and the bomb. At the center are a pile of jewels and a jug of wine. Two empty bottles rest beneath the table, green glass catching the candlelight.
Jude, the bomb calls happily. Sit down. We'll deal you in.
I am relieved to see her, here and unscathed. But nothing else about this tableau is any good. Cardin grins at me as though we've been great friends all our lives. I forgot how charming he can be, and how dangerous that is. What are you doing? I burst out. He's supposed to be tied up. He's our prisoner.
Worry not. Where's he going to go?
The roach asks.
You really think he can get past all three of us? I don't mind being one-handed,
Cardin interjects.
But if you're going to restrain both of my hands, then you'll have to pour the wine directly into my mouth.
He told us where the old king kept the really good bottles, says the bomb, pushing back her white hair. Not to mention a stash of jewelry that belonged to Elowyn. He figured that in the confusion, no one would notice if it got lifted. And so far, no one has. Easiest job the roach has ever done.
I want to scream. They weren't supposed to like him, but why wouldn't they? He's a prince who's treating them with respect. He's Dane's brother. He's folk, like them.
Everything is spiraling into chaos anyway,
says Cardin.
Might as well have some fun. Don't you think, Jude?
I take a deep breath. If he undermines my position here, if he manages to make me an outsider, then I am never going to get the Court of Shadows to go along with the plan that is still jumbled up in my head. I can't seem to figure out how to help anyone. The last thing I need is him making everything worse. What did he offer you? I ask. Like we're all in on the same joke. Yes, it's a gamble. Maybe Cardin didn't offer them anything at all. I try not to seem like I'm holding my breath. I try not to show how small Cardin makes me feel. The ghost gives me one of his rare smiles.
Mostly gold, but also power, position.
A lot of things he hasn't got, said the bomb.
I thought we were friends,
Cardin says half-heartedly.
I'm going to take him in back, I say, putting my hand on the top of the chair in a proprietary fashion.
I need to get him out of the room before he gets the better of me in front of them. I need to get him away now.
And do what? Asks the roach.
He's my prisoner, I remind them, squatting down and slicing through the strips of my dress, still tying his legs to the chair. I realize he must have slept this way, sitting upright, if he slept at all. But he doesn't look tired. He smiles down at me, as if the reason I'm on my knees is because I am curtsying. I want to wipe that smile off his face, but maybe I can't. Maybe he'll go on smiling that way to his grave.
Can't we stay out here?
Cardin asks me.
There's wine out here.
That makes the roach snicker.
Something bothering you, princeling? You and Jude don't get along after all.
Cardin's expression shifts into something that appears to resemble worry. Good. I lead him into Dane's office, which I guess I've just commandeered for my own. He walks unsteadily, his legs stiff from being bound. Also possibly because he has helped my crew down several bottles of wine. No one stops me from taking him, though. I close the door and turn the lock. "Sit down," I tell him, pointing to a chair. He does. I walk around, settling myself on the other side of the desk. It occurs to me that if I kill him, I can finally stop thinking about him. If I kill him, I won't have to feel like this anymore. Without him, there's no clear path to putting Oak on the throne. I'd have to trust that Matic had some way of forcing Baelkin into crowning him. Without him, I have no cards to play. No plan. No helping my brother. No nothing. Maybe it would be worth it. The crossbow is where I left it, in the drawer of Dane's desk. I draw it out, cock it back, and point it at Cardin. He draws a ragged breath.
"You're going to shoot me?"
He blinks.
"Right now?"
My finger caresses the trigger. I feel calm. Gloriously calm. This is weakness. To put fear above ambition, above family, above love. But it feels good. It feels like being powerful.
"I can see why you'd want to,"
he says, as though reading my face and coming to some decision.
"But I'd really prefer if you didn't."
"Then you shouldn't have smirked at me constantly. You think I'm going to stand being mocked here, now? You still so sure you're better than me?" My voice shakes a little, and I hate him even more for it. I have trained every day to be dangerous, and he is entirely in my power. Yet I'm the one who is afraid. Fearing him is a habit I could break with a bolt to his heart. He holds up his hands in protest, long bare fingers splayed. I am the one with the royal ring.
"I'm nervous,"
he says.
"I smile a lot when I'm nervous. I can't help it."
That is not at all what I expected him to say. I lower the crossbow momentarily. He keeps talking, as though he doesn't want to leave me too much time to think.
"You are terrifying. Nearly my whole family is dead, and while they never had much love for me, I don't want to join them. I've spent all night worrying what you're going to do, and I know exactly what I deserve. I have a reason to be nervous."
He's talking to me as though we're friends instead of enemies. It works, too. I relax a little. When I realize that, I am nearly freaked out enough to shoot him outright.
"I'll tell you whatever you want," he says.
"Anything. No word games?" The temptation is enormous. Everything Taryn told me is still rattling around in my head, reminding me how little I know. He puts a hand over where his heart should be.
"I swear it."
"And if I shoot you anyway?"
"You might well,"
he says, wry.
"But I want your word that you won't."
"My word isn't worth much," I remind him.
"So you keep saying."
He raises his brows.
"It's not comforting, I've got to tell you."
I give a surprised laugh. The crossbow wavers in my hand. Cardin's gaze is locked on it. With deliberate slowness, I set it down on the wood of the desk. "You tell me whatever I want to know. All of it. And I won't shoot you."
"And what can I do to persuade you not to turn me over to Baelkin and Matic?"
He lifts a single eyebrow. I am not used to the force of his attention being on me like this. My heart speeds. All I can do is glower in return. "How about you concentrate on staying alive?" He shrugs.
"What do you want to know?"
"I found a piece of paper with my name on it," I say. "Over and over. Just my name." He flinches a little, but doesn't say anything. "Well," I prompt.
"That's not a question."
He groans, as though exasperated.
"Ask me a proper question, and I'll give you an answer."
"You're terrible at this whole telling me whatever I want to know thing." My hand goes to the crossbow,
but I don't pick it up. He sighs.
Just ask me something. Ask about my tail. Don't you want to see it?
He raises his brows.
I have seen his tail, but I am not going to give him the satisfaction of telling him that. You want me to ask you something? Fine. When did Taryn start whatever it is she has with Locke?
He laughs with delight.
This appears to be a discussion he isn't interested in avoiding. Typical.
Oh, I wondered when you would ask about that. It was some months ago. He told us all about it, throwing stones at her window, leaving her notes to meet him in the woods, wooing her by moonlight. He swore us to silence, made it all seem like a lark. I think, in the beginning, he did it to make Nikasia jealous. But later...
How did he know it was her room? I ask, frowning. That makes his smile grow.
Maybe he didn't. Maybe either of you would have done as his first mortal conquest. I believe his goal is to have both of you in the end.
I don't like any of this.
What about you?
He gives me a quick, odd look.
Locke hasn't gotten around to seducing me yet, if that's what you're asking. I suppose I should be insulted.
That's not what I mean. You and Nikasia were... I don't know what to call them. Together isn't quite the word for an evil and beautiful team, ruining people and enjoying it.
Yes. Locke stole her from me,
Cardin says with a tightness in his jaw. He doesn't smile, doesn't smirk. Clearly it costs him something to tell me this.
And I don't know if Locke wanted her to make some other lover jealous, or to make me angry, or just because of Nikasia's magnificence. Nor do I know what fault in me made her choose him. Now do you believe I am giving you the answers you were promised?
The thought of Cardin being broken-hearted is almost beyond my imagining. I nod. Did you love her?
What kind of question is that?
He demands. I shrug. I want to know.
Yes,
he says, his gaze on the desk, on my hand resting there. I'm suddenly conscious of my fingernails, bitten to the quick.
I loved her.
Why do you want me dead? I ask. Because I want to remind us both that answering embarrassing questions is the least of what he deserves. We're enemies, no matter how many jokes he tells or how friendly he seems. Charmers are charming, but that's all they are. He lets out a long breath and puts his head down on his hands, not paying nearly enough attention to the crossbow.
You mean with the Nixies? You were the one who was thrashing around and throwing things at them. They're extremely lazy creatures. But I thought you might actually annoy them into taking a bite out of you. I may be rotten, but my one virtue is that I'm not a killer. I wanted to frighten you. But I never wanted you dead. I never wanted anyone dead.
I think of the river and how, when one Nixie detached from the others, Cardin waited until it paused and then left, so we could get out of the water. I stare at him, at the traces of silver on his face from the party, at the inky black of his eyes. I suddenly remember how he pulled Valerian off me when I was choking on fairy fruit. I never wanted anyone dead. Against my will, I recall the way he held that sword in the study with Baelkin and the sloppiness of his technique. I thought he'd been doing that deliberately to annoy his brother. Now, for the first time, I consider the possibility that he just doesn't much like sword fighting, that he'd never learned it particularly well, that if we ever fought, I would win. I consider all the things I have done to become a worthy adversary of him. But maybe I haven't been fighting Cardin at all. Maybe I've been fighting my own shadow. Valerian tried to murder me outright. Twice. First in the tower, then in my room, at my house. Cardin lifts his head, and his whole posture stiffens as though some uncomfortable truth just came home to him.
I thought when you said you killed him, you meant that you tracked him down and...
His voice trails off, and he starts over.
Only a fool would break into the general's house.
I draw down the collar of my shirt so he can see where Valerian tried to strangle me. I have another on my shoulder from where he knocked me into the floor. Believe me yet? He reaches toward me, as though he's going to run his fingers over the bruises. I bring up the crossbow, and he thinks better of it.
Valerian liked pain, he says. Anyone's. Mine, even. I knew he wanted to hurt you.
He pauses, seeming to actually have heard his own words.
And he had. I thought he'd be satisfied with that.
It never occurred to me to wonder what it was like to be Valerian's friend. It sounds like it wasn't so different from being his enemy. So it doesn't matter that Valerian wanted to hurt me, I ask? So long as he wasn't going to kill me.
You have to admit, being alive is better.
Cardin returns, that faintly amused tone back in his voice. I put both of my hands on the desk. Just tell me why you hate me, once and for all. His long fingers smooth over the wood of Dane's desk.
You really want honesty?
I am the one with the crossbow, not shooting you because you promised me answers. What do you think?
Very well.
He fixes me with a spiteful look.
I hate you. Because your father loves you, even though you're a human brat born to his unfaithful wife. While mine never cared for me, though I am a prince of faerie. I hate you because you don't have a brother who beats you. And I hate you because Locke used you and your sister to make Nikasia cry after he stole her from me. Besides which, after the tournament, Baelkin never failed to throw you in my face as the mortal who could best me.
I didn't think Baelkin even knew who I was. We stare at each other across the desk. Lounging in the chair, Cardin looks every bit the wicked prince. I wonder if he expects to be shot. Is that all? I demand. Because it's ridiculous. You can't be jealous of me. You don't have to live at the sufferance of the same person who murdered your parents. You don't have to stay angry, because if you don't, there's a bottomless well of fear ready to open up under you. I stop speaking abruptly, surprised at myself. I said I wasn't going to be charmed, but I let him trick me into opening up to him. As I think that, Cardin's smile turns into a more familiar sneer.
Oh, really? I don't know about being angry. I don't know about being afraid. You're not the one bargaining for your life.
That's really why you hate me, I demand. Only that? There's no better reason? For a moment, I think he's ignoring me. But then I realize he's not answering because he can't lie. And he doesn't want to tell me the truth. Well, I say, lifting the crossbow again, glad to have a reason to reassert my position as the person in charge. Tell me. He leans in and closes his eyes.
Most of all, I hate you because I think of you. Often. It's disgusting, and I can't stop.
I am shocked into silence.
Maybe you should shoot me after all,
he says, covering his face with one long-fingered hand. You're playing me, I say. I don't believe him. I won't fall for some silly trick, because he thinks I am some fool to lose my head over beauty. If I was, I couldn't last a single day in faerie. I stand, ready to call his bluff. Crossbows aren't great at close range, so I trade mine for a dagger. He doesn't look up as I walk around the desk to him. I place the tip of the blade against the bottom of his chin, as I did the day before in the hall, and I tilt his face toward mine. He shifts his gaze with obvious reluctance. The horror and the shame on his face look entirely too real. Suddenly, I am not so sure what to believe.
and lean toward him.
Close enough for a kiss.
His eyes widen.
The look in his face is some commingling of panic and desire. It is a heady feeling, having power over someone. Over Cardin, who I never thought had any feelings at all.
You really do want me, I say,
close enough to feel the warmth of his breath as it hitches.
And you hate it.
I change the angle of my knife, turning it so it's against his neck. He doesn't look nearly as alarmed by that as I might expect. Not nearly as alarmed as when I bring my mouth to his.
Chapter 26.
I don't have a lot of experience with kisses. There was Locke, and before him, no one. But kissing Locke never felt the way that kissing Cardin does. Like taking a dare to run over knives. Like an adrenaline strike of lightning. Like the moment when you've swum too far out in the sea and there is no going back. Only cold black water closing over your head. Cardin's cruel mouth is surprisingly soft.